Well, chances are it just is a natural progression. It's not that anyone did something incorrect. These lakes are changing.
Welcome to Working in the Weeds. I'm Christine Krebs, the Communications Manager out here at the Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants. And as per usual, we have Dr. Farrell across from me.
Hello, Christine.
Hello. And today we're having another Lake Personalities conversation. And we are so excited to have Eric Nagid, an FWC biologist who's super familiar with Orange Lake up here, actually really close to Gainesville. So this one is close to home for us.
Yeah, we're coming to you from a packed studio today with our guest. But we want to get back into this conversation about lake personalities. So every time you go to a lake, you have to realize you're dealing with an individual. And not only does that lake, it can be very different from ones that are close by. It can even be different as you move forward in time or back in time. So these lakes are really snapshots and you have to understand them. But the lake we want to focus on today is the amazing, beautiful Orange Lake. And there's very few people in the country that have spent more time both as a researcher and as a recreational user of Orange Lake than Eric Nagid. So Eric, thanks for coming in and sharing your expertise with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So before we get started, talk a little bit about how you got to where you are, because if I remember correctly, you grew up in a really urban part of South Florida. So how does a fisheries biologist come from an urban setting?
Yeah, so you're right. I grew up in South Florida in West Palm, and while I was there, I always had that outdoor enthusiast aspect of me. I grew up on the Palm Beach Canal, so a lot of freshwater fishing. Saltwater fishing was in my blood, but that was harder to get to. Couldn't drive, didn't have a boat until later on. So later on in my life, I had a good friend that had a ranch out in Okeechobee, so I spent a lot of my high school days out in Okeechobee. So it's always been a part of who I am. Fast forwarding to college, it's hard for me to pinpoint how I decided or when I decided this is what I want to do with my life. But I started out in environmental engineering, and then I realized that wasn't for me. I reshuffled over to the wildlife department, knowing that I wanted to have some job within fisheries. I took the Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences course, and then later I took a summer and worked for Dr. Camford with the Florida Lake Watch program, and then from there I was hooked.
That's when you got bit by the bug.
You got it.
So talk about now, so you ended up fulfilling that dream. You're now with FWRI within FWC. So what do you do in that role?
So currently I'm a research administrator where I have spent the last 5 years, but prior to that I spent 17 years as the research and monitoring lead for the Orange Creek Basin.
So I think we found the perfect person to talk about Orange Lake.
I think so. There's lots of other people, but I'm pretty well equipped.
So let's just get right into Orange Lake then, because this is one that I hear about it all the time. And even before I was associated with the aquatic side of this business, people talk about it even out in the community. Orange Lake comes up all the time. You start looking at the literature. Orange Lake is always a lake that has been studied, that's in the published literature. And for years I thought, well, it's just because it's close. You know, when you're 30 miles from a huge research institution, just by proximity, you're going to make it into the paper, right? But then you start realizing, no, Orange Lake is a really big deal and has been for decades. So start off just kind of like, what is Orange Lake and why has it been a destination? And why is it still such a big part of our culture?
Such a great question. Orange Lake has this famed history as being a sport fish destination and has been for such a long time. So that's one part of it. But it also has this appeal to researchers and biologists because of the nature of the hydrology of the lake. And we can get into a lot of that, you know, the ups and downs that it's seen. And because it has these ups and downs, the expansive vegetation that occurs there, there's a lot of reasons. There's even been ecotourism back in the 50s about come see the Orange Lake floating islands. You know, there's always had this allure. And definitely built around sport fishing, but it also has all these other facets to it that are really quite fascinating.
Well, even in turn of the century, 1900s, turn of the century, there was all sorts of birding that was going on, and people were documenting all sorts of bird life and how they were migrating, and a lot of it was done on Orange Lake.
That's right. The plume industry was really booming at that time, and you know, Florida Audubon actually Audubon itself, not Florida Audubon, it essentially protected Bird Island and Redbird Island, you know, because it was such a ludicrous industry.
Well, and it's just amazing as a scientist and all that you have to do now to publish papers. And then you read these reports. A guy just literally sat there for 2 weeks and reported what birds flew in and out. And it's a famed paper. And it's like, oh, to have been a scientist 100 years ago, man, it had to have been easier. But then again, I didn't have to go camp for 2 weeks and count birds. So I guess that's the downside. But so, all right. So tell us about where is Orange Lake and what is the primary use of it today?
Okay. Well, Orange Lake is in the Orange Creek Basin. And so that basin is made up of three primary lakes. Noonan's Lake at the very north end drains down into Payne's Prairie. And then you have Loch Lusa in the middle. And Orange Lake is at the southern end of the basin. I mentioned Payne's Prairie because I think it's noteworthy. I think it has a lot of comparisons that we might or may not get into with some of Orange Lake's history.
I don't think you can talk about one without talking about the other.
That's right.
All right. So it's right here in the Alachua-Marion County area. And you've already said that it has been for decades a sports fishing destination, but it also has a rich history for birding and the whole plume trade. So why do you say it is a sport fish destination more than a birding destination?
Well, just because that's the primary use that we've seen in the last several decades.
Okay.
When you look at our recreational users, you don't see a lot of homes on the lake. You don't see a lot of other recreational types of activities going on there. Certainly fishing is primary, hunting secondary, and then a lot of passive wildlife use is probably tertiary. So the bulk of the use has always been from a sport fish perspective.
So describe the lake just in physical terms, because it's not a very deep lake.
Right.
And you've talked about the famous floating islands. Mm-hmm. So we know tussocks are not a big deal, but it seems like it is a bigger scenario on Orange than just about anywhere else. So talk about what that means for Orange Lake.
Right. So if you compare Orange Lake to the other three lakes in the basin, Orange Lake has a gentler slope. And so what that means relative to the other lakes is that it just has more of an expansive, shallow area relative to these other lakes. And you think of the sediments and the rich nutrients that are in that basin, it just means that it's going to grow a lot of plants, and it's going to grow a lot of different types of plants. So when you talk to biologists and you mention Orange Lake, the one thing they always say is dynamic. Diverse, you know, those are words that a biologist would say, and that's because it's constantly changing. When you go out to Orange Lake and you look at the vegetative community, it might be completely different from where you were standing a week ago. That's how quickly it can change. That's not the way it really is on Noonan's Lake or Loch Lusa Lake, where they tend to have more of a stable vegetative community.
Well, I believe it was Orange Lake that in the 80s was the first lake that went 100% cover from hydrilla. First documented case of 100% cover.
Right.
And then, so we know it grows hydrilla.
Right.
And then there was a span of time for about 10 years, there was almost no hydrilla.
Mm-hmm.
It's now starting to come back. So what plants are there now, and what are you expecting it to look like 5 or 10 years from now?
Yeah, great question. So the plants that are there now, we certainly have a lot of hydrilla, like you mentioned. I talked about the expansive vegetation that occurs in a lake, and so we try to separate those out into deep marsh and shallow marsh types of habitats. So, you know, deep marsh will include spatterdock, you know, pads, lilies.
And we're talking 5-7 feet?
Right, correct. Okay. Not grass fringe, which is commonly referred to as Egyptian paspalidium. And then the shallow marsh is usually more interior of that deep marsh, as the word suggests, shallower water. That's going to be more of your maiden cane communities, cattails, bulrushes, sawgrasses. But then you also have expansive shallow marsh. You have shrub swamp. We've already talked about floating islands. You have actual islands that we've talked about that Loch Lusa and Noonan's don't have. It's so diverse, and it's quite different from those other lakes.
So you mentioned that a lot of it is driven by a very nutrient-rich environment. So where does the water come from and where are the nutrients coming from?
Yeah, great question. So most of our, at least in this part of Florida, we have a very nutrient-rich sediment layer called the Hawthorne Formation. And it tends to be very rich in phosphatic clays and sands. And it's also this layer that confines the surface water from the Florida aquifer. So just from natural geology, we have a very, very nutrient-rich substrate. But then we also have a lot of nutrients coming in from the landscape, you know. And so the primary inputs coming into Orange Lake are River Styx, which is draining Paynes Prairie to some extent, and coming in from Cross Creek, which is draining some of what Lock Luce's watershed.
So basically all of the nutrients from Gainesville are going to end up in Orange Lake pretty quickly, right?
I don't know if you could say all of it, a good portion of it. About 50% of it is diverted to Orange Lake, and the other 50% is going to Paynes Prairie. But it's a good chunk of it.
Now, you mentioned the connection with Paynes Prairie. Mm-hmm. So let's just go ahead and talk about, I know historically versus now, what is the role and what is the influence that Paynes Prairie exerts on Orange Lake?
Right. So historically, the water from Noonan's Lake used to sheet flow across Paynes Prairie. And Paynes Prairie at any time could have been a lake or it could have been a savanna. So when you think about, if you've ever read Bartram's work in the late 1700s, he describes it as, you know, this great savanna. And then you fast forward in the late 1800s, and for 20 or so more years, it was Alachua Lake.
Right.
And to the point where there was actually steamboats on the water body, and that was one of the primary ways of getting commerce and trade from that part of the sink over to southern Gainesville. So it's got this dichotomy of this alternate stable states in a lot of ways, of whether it's a prairie or whether it's a lake. And so fast forwarding again, there was a man by name Mr. Camp. He wanted to essentially run cattle. And he wanted to ensure that, you know, it was more of a prairie. And so he essentially replumbed the system in a lot of ways to what we see today, to where a lot of the water is being diverted to Orange Lake.
And he dig a canal or
he
what?
He dug a canal, which essentially connected Prairie Creek from Noonan's Lake to the River Styx of Orange Lake.
Okay. So, and then how long was that in place? And because it got deconnected, that's a word.
So that would have been from the 20s to about the 70s. And then in the 70s, when Paynes Prairie became a park, then they reconnected some of that flow to Paynes Prairie, about 50%, and then the other 50% was still going to Orange Lake.
So basically what that's done is Orange Lake is historically a very shallow water body.
Correct.
16,000 acres-ish?
We normally consider it being about 12 to 13,000 acres.
Okay. So it's a shallow lake to begin with. It does shrink and swell with pool. But it sounds like when Camp put in the Camp Canal, it was held artificially high for several decades.
That's correct. And you couple that with a weir that was put in the outlet, in the Orange Lake outlet, in the 1960s. That notch was held at 57 feet somewhere in there. So that was the new, quote-unquote, average water depth, was at 57 feet above mean sea level.
So why was that structure put in place?
To hold more water in Orange Lake, essentially, to try to minimize the duration that we had these frequent ups and downs that Orange Lake was so famous for.
So before you put in the water control structure, the weir, when it went way down, right?
Way down. 1956 was the first time, at least in our recorded history, that showed it just completely bottom out. It went to less than 5,000 acres. One of the reasons for that is a sinkhole that opened up at the south end of the lake. There are stories of homeowners and townspeople putting anything they could in that sinkhole to prevent it from accepting more water, even as much as cars going into the sinkhole.
Yeah, I've heard lore of there's a school bus down there.
Right, right. You know, who knows how much of that is true, but it's still good for the folklore.
Yeah, and I've even read stories that when it went really down, that they were actually farmers coming in and growing vegetables on the muck, so they were farming the lake bottom for a few years.
That's right. Something also really interesting, again, adding to the fact that this is something that's always been part of Orange Lake history, is there's been cores done in the center of Orange Lake. And we know that there are charcoal deposits out in the middle of the lake ranging from 200 years to 1,000 years. So the lake used to go down and completely burn over throughout its history multiple times. So this is something that's always been a facet of Orange Lake, not necessarily something that happens on Lock Luce or Noonan's.
Well, that's where I was wanting to go next. So you've got Newnans and Loch Lusa that are physically very, very close in the same watershed, but they don't seem to go dry.
No.
So talk about what those lakes are. What are they trying to be? Because it sounds like Orange Lake really wants to be a prairie. It's trying to turn itself into a grass prairie, and we're not letting it. But what does Loch Lusa and Newnan want to be?
Right. So great question. And it's interesting you say they want to be a prairie, because when I think about Orange Lake's personality, the things that came to mind for me were it likes to be the center of attention relative to these other lakes. There's always something happening on Orange Lake. It gets so much attention. It's an attention hog. But it also has this hidden identity where it doesn't know if it wants to be a lake or a wet prairie. And that's where I think the connections and the comparisons between what we see on Orange Lake and Payne's Prairie are really fascinating. The difference between Orange Lake, Newnans Lake, and Loch Lusa is that Orange Lake at the southern end has the Ocala Formation exposed more at the surface. And the Ocala Formation is the thing that that confining layer is uncovering. So water can either come into the lake when the Ocala Formation is exposed, or it can go down. And in this case, since the potential metric surface of the Ocala Formation is lower than the lake level, when it gets low, it's going to want to accept water. So Newnans and Loch Lusa just don't have that feature. They don't have that Ocala Formation that's closer to the surface, and they don't have that sinkhole formation that's accepting water during droughts.
So the Ocala Formation is underground in the aquifer, or?
It's the limestone formation that is underneath that hawthorn layer that I talked about, that confining layer. And so when that confining layer breaks down, it exposes the Ocala Formation.
So you talked earlier about on Orange Lake, historically we've had ups and downs on hydrilla, but there's always been spatter dock, paspalidium, all of these other plants, frog's bit. There's more frog's bit on Orange Lake than I've seen anywhere else. Now, compare and contrast that to Newnans, because there's not a lot of plants on Newnans, hardly at all.
That's right. And it's strange why Newnans, you know, one thing about Newnans Lake is that it just doesn't have the littoral zone that Orange Lake does. A lot of that has to do with that gradient that I was talking about. You know, it drops off a little bit quicker. Not that these lakes are deep, but it just drops off deeper and quicker than Orange Lake does. But yet that east shoreline of Newnans Lake has really nice sand substrate. It should grow a lot of plants, but it just doesn't relative to Orange Lake. So Orange Lake just has a disproportionate amount of shallow water area that Newnans and Loch Lusa don't have. Loch Lusa behaves a little bit more similarly to Orange Lake in that you start to get those extensive pad fields and some of that deep marsh that's characterized by Egyptian paspalidium. As you move into Little Loch Lusa, you do start to see some of that tussock formation and that shrub marsh. And that makes sense because it's a little bit more connected to Orange Lake, but still behaves quite differently than Orange Lake.
Every time I fly into Gainesville, you go right over top of Newnans. And every time I look down, I have one thought: green.
Yeah.
There is a lot of green algae on Newnans, and you don't see that in Orange. So why is Newnans so algae dominated when these others that are more at the end of the line where the nutrients should really build up? I would think it would be the opposite.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So Newnans, I think we've already talked about it in a lot of ways, because it doesn't have all the plants that Orange has. You know, it doesn't have the ability to take up some of those nutrients, and those nutrients are going to get taken up by whatever's there. And in a Newnans Lake, it tends to be primarily algal dominated. And over time, that's gotten a little bit worse. And that's interesting because that was part of my thesis when I came to the University of Florida, was trying to understand the nutrient dynamics of Newnans Lake. And there was a drastic increase in the early 90s that really wasn't explicable by the nutrient loads that we were seeing. And so nutrient loading being, you know, the amounts of nutrients that are coming in from streams in a drainage basin. So when we looked at the amount of nutrients that were coming in and comparing that to the inlet concentrations, it didn't add up. The math just simply wasn't there. And so what we decided was that what the data told us was that there was a lot of internal nutrient cycling that goes on in Newnans Lake. Basically, wind resuspension, getting those flocculent sediments resuspended and then releasing nutrients. And so sometimes lakes can be a sink of nutrients, but they can also be a source of nutrients. And so that's really what's going on Newnans Lake. Wakaloosa Lake tends to be a little bit more insulated from that internal loading. But as you move down to Orange Lake, once you get down to Orange Lake, all those plants in that system are really taking up so much more of those nutrients. And so we don't see those big algal blooms like we do on Noonan's Lake.
And those plants with high nutrient loading, that's what drives that fishery, right?
100%.
So wasn't it Orange Lake that was recently cataloged as one of the top 10 bass fishing lakes in the world?
It is. And more recently, because we're in one of those sweet spots, so to speak, of just it has the magic, so much so that we've pinned it up against one of the other really hot lakes is Fellsmere, and we had a trophy bass challenge. And the idea was to document the total amount of weight that anglers were catching between these two lakes within the same season. Now, the season ended and Fellsmere won by a couple hundred pounds. I can't remember what it was, but what we did notice is that the amount of trophy bass fish that were submitted by Orange Lake anglers was somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60, maybe even 70 trophy fish. And these are fish that are over 8 pounds. What's even more impressive was four of those were what we consider Hall of Fame fish, over 13 pounds.
Gee whiz.
So these are absolute giants. And so those are ones that were just registered in the trophy catch program. We do know of one of the heaviest fish, really, in recent history, which is a 15-pound, 9-ounce fish, an absolute monster caught by somebody else that was on the lake that also caught a 13-pound fish. So in the same day, we have a 15, 9, and a 13-pound fish caught by two lady anglers. It was quite a story.
So things are just lining up for Orange Lake right now.
They are.
So if you're going to talk to anglers and say, all right, if you're going to be on Orange, what type of fish are you going to target? If you're on Noonan's, what type of fish are you going to target?
On Orange Lake, the predominant fishery has been bass, and a lot of that has to do with the hydrilla conditions that are out there. Now, we have a hard time dealing with the management of hydrilla. It's obviously, you've talked about this, I'm sure, in previous podcasts. It's a tricky thing to manage, but it's also something that is an attractant to both bass and also to anglers. So when you have hydrilla, you're attracting bass anglers, whereas brim anglers and crappie anglers really don't want to see a lot of hydrilla out there. They really don't want to have a lot of submersed vegetation in general, never mind hydrilla, because they're fishing open water and it's basically a nuisance to them and their boats. They don't have the high-powered engines that maybe the bass anglers do. So Noonan's Lake, Wakaloosa Lake is definitely going to attract more of the brim and crappie anglers, speck anglers, whereas Orange Lake has always had a long history of attracting the largemouth bass anglers.
Yeah, in my mind, if you're going to Orange Lake, you're going to target bass. If you're wanting to target crappie, you need to be on Noonan's with everybody else.
That's right. That's right.
And it's still really high-quality fish coming off Noonan's, but it's just a totally different scenario.
Completely different, right? And the anglers just segregate themselves that way. They just know, and word of mouth, it just depends on Wakaloosa is the hot one or Noonan's the hot one for crappies. They're going to figure it out. They're going to talk, and then that's where everyone's going.
Well, it just always cracks me up. Getting into this time of year, the crappie fishing really starts to ramp up. And you'll go by the boat ramp at Noonan's, and there's nobody there. There's nobody there. There's nobody there. And then everybody's
there.
Mm-hmm. So it's just amazing. The word of mouth, when it's hot and ready to go, boy, people come in.
That's right.
So we were talking about the fisheries that are amazing out in Orange Lake, and you both also talked about it drying up about 15 years ago. Why did that happen? Is that common? And did that affect the fisheries at all?
Yeah, I don't see other lakes do that.
Right. And so that gets to the unique aspect that we've been trying to hit along this whole time with why is Orange Lake different and special. So it does go through these drawdown periods, and it's largely responsible for the outcome of the fishery 8, 9, 10 years later. And so we talked about that sinkhole at the south end opening up, drying up the lake. When I first started in 2001, 2002, we had the greatest drought on record where the lake literally shrunk down to less than 2,000 acres, believe it or not.
Good grief.
And so it was down for that time for a long time. And so what's going on is it's actually a time for the lake to reset. It basically reshuffles the deck, so to speak. And so the sediments are getting oxidized, they're getting aerated. Once water refills, you have this trophic upsurge, meaning all this energy, all this nutrient coming into the system, and the fish that remain in the system were able to hang on are having massive fecundity and massive reproduction.
So, all right, so we've got the lake's low. It starts to fill back up, so new nutrients are coming in. Meanwhile, the sediments have been primed to release the nutrients stored in them.
Right. And also you have all these plants, these terrestrial plants that have grown on the lake bottom for the last year that are suddenly dying and adding nutrients to the system. So it's what we call this trophic upsurge. We can't really talk about the mechanisms that well. We just know what happens. And what the result is this accelerated growth that gets channeled into a big year class of fish. And what I mean by year class of fish is all fish that were born within 1 year. And all that energy goes in these fish, and it's a bumper crop, so to speak. And that bumper crop is sustaining the fishery or the fish population for 7-8 years. And meanwhile, they're growing at this accelerated rate. So we can have 8-pound fish that are only 4-5 years old. And so you fast forward that a little bit. If they're already had that competitive advantage, by the time they reach 8-9 years old, we have the scenario where you just have absolute giants in the lake.
So you have more fish are eating more fish. Bigger fish are getting bigger. Meanwhile, the reproductive rates are still super high, so they're backfilling on small fish at the same time.
You got it.
So you just have everything happening because you have this huge spike in nutrients coming out of that really low drought period.
That's exactly right.
Wow. So how long is this going to be forever? So are we going to be in this rock and roll state for 20 or 30 years?
At some point, it's going to fizzle out. History tells us that it's going to fizzle out. So we're at this peak where we know things are happening right now. We know things are really special right now. And so we're doing everything we can to extend that specialness, right? We've restricted summer tournaments. We're actually proposing different regulations actually right now as we speak, where we want to make sure that we're releasing fish that are over 20 inches, and we want to use circle hook only for live bait. So we're doing things. It's all part of this trophy bass project. Those last two things haven't been implemented yet, but those are the types of things we're considering to keep the specialness that we're talking about going on longer. But at some point, natural mortality is going to catch up with these giant bass. Right. And so we're trying to maximize that as much as we can in hopes that we do get 15 plus pound fish and maybe even a state record. Our state record is 17.27. We're really close to that. And it's these special moments, it's the magic that could possibly produce a fish in that size class.
So how often historically speaking, does Orange Lake go super, super, super low?
Right. So 1956 is the one that we know was a really low event. Prior to that, we only have water records going to the 1937. So we don't have a big period of record prior to that. So 1956 was the first one. Then you have the early 90s. So 1991, 1992. And then 2000 to 2001, 2002, that was the big one. That was the lowest drought on record. And then 2011, 2012. And so 2013, the water fills up. Those are the fish that we're dealing with right now.
So what I'm hearing is that these wet-dry cycles are driving the fishery, and it happens every 15 to 40 years.
Yeah.
So I guess the moral of the story is take advantage of it right now because we may not have conditions like that again in our lifetime.
That's exactly right. These drawdown periods have been more frequent in recent decades. Like I said, the first one was in the 1950s, but then the last 30 years, it's been occurring every 10 to 12 years, right? So it could continue with that pattern, or we could go back to this longer period where we don't see another big drawdown event for 30, 40 years, like you said. So absolutely take advantage of that. But it'll be a sad story when it goes down. It always is. It's hard to watch fish and wildlife deteriorate in that way, and it's hard to watch a lake like that disappear. But it's also part of the process.
Well, you're right. It is super sad when you stand on a boat ramp and you look and the water is 1,000 feet away and you know there's no way to get to it.
You hang on to the thought that this is going to reshuffle the deck. It's going to hit the reset button. And in a few years, you're going to be right back in that period where you're going to have this massive production. And then a few years from that, you're going to have this awesome fishery.
Well, I think we're at a place now to kind of wrap up and bring together a lot of these ideas that we've talked about. And I really want to focus on what you just said with some final thoughts, because it is very tempting to set your whole mind on what Orange Lake is right now and go, my gracious, it's perfect. I remember going out there with my dad and caught 2 13-pound fish. And then in 15 years, you go out and it's just different. And it's going to be very tempting to say, oh, well, somebody changed the lake, right? DEP messed it up. FWC messed it up. Something happened. Well, chances are it just is a natural progression. It's not that anyone did something incorrect. These lakes are changing. They are just dynamic and they are going to come and go. And we need to realize, enjoy the good times when they're here and then understand that it's going to be different.
Great point. And, you know, this is a conversation that we often have with stakeholders. And, you know, some stakeholders might complain about something and they'll say, you know, I've never seen a lake this way. And we say, well, how long have you been here? And they'll say, well, I've been here 5 years. And, well, you know, thanks, but frankly, that's not long enough to talk about some of the changes and
the
progressions.
Nor is 15 years.
Exactly right.
So you've got to have a different perspective.
Exactly.
Well, and I will commonly hear people say, we need to restore the lake. And Bill Howler taught me this years ago. He said, restore it to what? Restore it to pre-1950 when they put in the water control structure? Restore it to when Camp built the canal and increased water levels for 50 or 60 years? Restore to what? Because, or restore it to when there's carbon charcoal deposits for when the lake was almost dry and burned 1,000 years ago. So restore to what? And that's the thing, is we've got to understand that these lakes can't just be one thing forever.
That's exactly right. I mean, any type of restoration goal, you know, prior to these, you know, pre-European settlement, those are unachievable and more than likely unattainable. So we try to avoid that completely. What we're trying to do is manage within the constraints and the boundaries that the lake has always offered within our known period of record. So we try to think of things in big percentages and not like species-specific types of plants. We're trying to manage things in terms of deep marsh, the amount of shallow marsh, the amount of shrub swamp, and trying to make sure that those things don't get too wildly out of bounds. We talked about these fluctuations that happen in water level, and when that happens, we do see this migration of what used to be shallow marsh into something different, like shrub swamp. And so some of our management style is, once we get those water level conditions back, we want to try to convert that and try to reclaim a little bit of shallow marsh by getting rid of some of the shrub swamp that may have been, I don't know, quote unquote, artificially created, you know. So that's been our management style, is not going back to some type of pre-European type of vision or outlook. It's just been more managing within the boundaries that Orange Lake has always provided.
Christine, what are some of your final thoughts today?
Yeah, I think through learning from this episode specifically, it's just the incredible history that a lot of these lakes have in Florida, and especially Orange Lake. Having done a lot of my education at UF, being able to know that a lake nearby like that has such a rich history and has looked different for a lot of different students and anglers that are nearby and residents. And I think another thing for the listeners is, it's so important to go to these stakeholder meetings to connect with biologists like Eric and those that work on these management plans and know the rich history of these lakes, so you can ask questions and wonder why the lake looks the way it does now and what is the goal for the future and how you as a stakeholder can contribute to that story as well.
Eric, any final thoughts?
None, other than it's been my pleasure. I really enjoy talking with you all today. I really do enjoy this idea of, you know, personifying a lake. I think that's brilliant. And it's really a great way to really understand the behavior and the character of a lake. So I appreciate you inviting me.
Well, Eric, thank you. This has been a fascinating discussion. Orange Lake is a tremendous resource for the state of Florida and for the southern U.S. in general. And if you've spent very much time on it, you realize why people used to drive from all over the country to come and vacation here. And if you haven't spent time on Orange Lake lately, you should.
No doubt.
All right. So thank you for listening to Working in the Weeds. If you have any suggestions or ideas for the podcast, please email us at caip@ifis.ufl.edu. That's cape@ifis.ufl.edu. And stay tuned for the next episode as we continue to turn science into solutions.